This interview is being recorded in Buffalo, New York, and we are fortunate to have with us His Excellency Bishop Williamson, who was consecrated a bishop by His Grace Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre on June 30th of this year. Your Excellency, perhaps we should begin by relating the dramatic series of events leading up to the consecrations, which began last year. I think it began last year when the Archbishop announced his intention to consecrate bishops.
That was the 29th of June of 1987, yes. He could see that Rome was not moving, that he's growing older and at the age of 81, 82 can't be too far from death. And he had to take action. He's been talking with Rome, dialoguing with Rome for all of these years in the hope that Rome would move. Rome has not done anything serious to provide tradition with a sure future, and so he announced in his sermon at the ordinations of 1987 his intention to consecrate bishops, and that certainly set the cat among the pigeons, and then Rome immediately began to react, and on July the 14th, also last year, the Archbishop Lefebvre repeated his demand or request for a bishop, the 28th of July, there was a reaction which gave some little hope. Cardinal Ratzinger seemed to be willing. There was a faint hope that Rome would grant to tradition, that's it, to traditional Catholicism, a place within the official church. And it's because of that hope that the Archbishop continued to negotiate for nearly a complete year. And the Archbishop only broke off when it was apparent that that hope was an illusion and that Rome's real intention all along was simply to pull the traditionalists back into the conciliar church.
Now, I gather that the first proposal that Rome made was not very good. It was for some type of a cardinal visitor.
Well, the Archbishop had for a long time been asking for a visitor, that's a visitation. He'd been saying to Rome, look, come and check out what we're doing, come and see what we're doing before you make a judgment or before you, condemn us, or come and see, come and visit the houses of the society, visit the seminaries and so on. And that is finally what Rome agreed to last year, at the end of last year. And it was Cardinal Gagnon who was chosen to make the visitation, which he did from early November to early December. For 1 month he was visiting above all houses of the society in Europe, in France, Germany and Switzerland. And that visitation was actually what the Archbishop had been hoping for. And Cardinal Gagnon then went back to Rome, took back to Rome a report on the society, of which we have heard that it was very largely favorable. One sinister little fact is that after that report went onto the Pope's desk in, I think, January the 5th of this year, the Archbishop in all of the negotiations this year since January has never seen what was in the report. Nobody in the society has seen what was in the report. And Rome, in all the negotiations, the Roman authorities never mentioned what was in the report either. Which suggests that they couldn't say what was in the report because it was too favorable. Because if they said what was in the report, then the question would be, well, in that case, why don't you give us, if it's all so good and if it's all so Catholic, why don't you give us a place inside the church? So if they didn't mention it, it's because they didn't want to give a place, they didn't want their own report to demonstrate to everybody that they should be making a place, making room for the society inside the church.
How did Cardinal Gagnon's visit to the society's houses in Switzerland and in France and Germany go?
Well, it went very well. He was very well received. He, in France, for instance, the Cardinal Gagnon definitely enjoyed himself. Both he and Monsignor Pearl made very favorable remarks on their travels around. When Cardinal Gagnon was separated from Monsignor Pearl, he made especially warm and kind remarks. Cardinal Gagnon made remarks like, you know, this is the future of the church. He was very impressed by the large families with plenty of children that he found at the centers. He was also very impressed by the society's youth movements and the large number of young people following the society and enthusiastically following the priests of the society. Both Monsignor Pearl and Monsignor Gagnon had plenty of opportunity to see all the good that's being done. And this, at least some of this, went into the report. We know from the remarks that they made while they were, for instance, in France.
Now, there is one incident which disturbed me about these visitation by Cardinal Gagnon, and it wasn't anything, of course, that Cardinal Gagnon did himself, but he was going to be saying the Tridentine Mass at St. Nicholas de Chardonnay, and at that point, Cardinal Ratzinger and Cardinal Casseroli intervened to stop him.
Yes. Well, that was Rome recognizing that if Cardinal Gagnon did actually say that Mass, it would really be too clear that Rome can have nothing against what was going on in St. Nicolas du Chardonnay. I mean, if the Cardinal himself celebrates a major Mass, you know, Sunday morning Mass at St. Nicolas du Chardonnay, then he can't logically condemn what's happening in St. Nicolas de Chardonnay, because he himself is heading it up. So it's understandable that Rome backtracked at that point and tried to undo, tried to prevent the Cardinal committing himself too much in favor of tradition. But it's typical of the Roman authorities' mode of proceeding that they sort of hold in check their own men from doing what's quite simply Catholic.
Like, to me, that would have looked like a goodwill gesture on the part of Rome. Because they refused to give him that permission to say that Tridentine Mass, at that point, I became very suspicious about Rome's intentions. If they truly want an agreement, why not make some of these goodwill gestures?
Yes, wise after the event, we could say that this was one of those indications that they weren't really seeking to accommodate tradition within the Catholic, within the official church. What they're trying to do is to arrive at some agreement which will entice traditionalists enough to draw them away from tradition and back into the conciliar church. What the Roman authorities exactly have in mind is a mystery, but they surely do not have the Catholic faith. They simply don't have the Catholic faith because they have no understanding of the people who do have the Catholic faith. They don't understand how Catholics react, how Catholics think, how Catholics what Catholics value, who do have the faith. The language of the faith is like Greek to these Roman authorities.
Well, when these negotiations were going on, the Roman authorities seemed to want an agreement for political reasons, simply to forestall the Archbishop from consecrating bishops without their permission. Another factor after the fact that might have made us a bit suspicious is the fact that they weren't really looking for an agreement before the Archbishop asked his intention to consecrate bishops. It was only simply a reaction on their part after the Archbishop made this statement.
Yes, I think that's true. And also, they wanted an agreement with the Archbishop in order to act as a counterweight to the crazy liberals inside the official church. As the left-wingers are going more and more left-wing, Rome needed the Archbishop inside the church to act as a kind of bugaboo. You know, you used to say to the little children, you know, behave or we'll get the policeman to come after you. You know, the policeman will come round. Well, you know, they would say to the crazy liberals, look, you behave, otherwise we'll get Archbishop Lefebvre after you, and so on and so on. So it would have been a diplomatic and political coup to hold the Archbishop within the framework of their conciliar church. But it wasn't to be.
Well, I think that there were signs that for the last few years, Rome has sort of been playing the Archbishop off against the modernists. For example, there have been some kind of nice things said about the Archbishop from the Roman officials. They seem to have told a number of laymen that it was okay to attend society masses, for example.
Yes. They've been playing games with the Archbishop. They've been looking at the Archbishop's defense of tradition in purely human and political terms from the standpoint of the way in which they wish to maneuver the church or the Catholic population as a whole. And that has got, that motivation and mentality has got little or nothing to do with the defense of the Catholic faith. And that mentality we've had reason to fear for many, many years. It's the mentality behind the Second Vatican Council, the mentality of adapting the church to the world, of getting in synchronization with the modern world. That mentality, Rome gave a hope of something else in July of last year and then through to the visitation, but as the negotiations this year continued on their course, by the middle of May, it was clear to the Archbishop that, you know, Rome would not change, and Rome had not changed and would not change, and that's why he broke off negotiations.
But wasn't there an agreement signed as of May the 5th of this year?
There was an agreement signed. The course of events was that as a result of the report of Cardinal Gagnon, the Pope proposed a first commission on which there would be no members of the society. That never got off the ground. He then there was a second commission proposed in which a theologian and a canon law of the society and a theologian and a canon lawyer of Rome and a vice president and a president from Rome, six of them. The president would be Cardinal Rassi, who wouldn't necessarily be always there, but the five of them then would meet together and discuss the basis of an agreement. Now, they met in the middle of April, finally, and down in Rome in secrecy, and they put together an agreement, which was then discussed again at the beginning of May, May 3rd and 4th, above all, I think, by Cardinal Rassi in person and by the Archbishop in person, and the result was a text of an agreement, which was firstly doctrinal and then juridical, let's say the doctrinal basis on which we could agree, and then a proposal of adaptations so that according to canon law, the society could be blended back into the official church, so to speak. These proposals were drawn up in a protocol, and the protocol was signed by Cardinal Ratzinger and by Archbishop Lefebvre on May the 5th, which is the feast day of St. Pius the 5th. And that agreement, the signing of that agreement, got into the press, and that's what May gave a number of people at the time great hopes. But even at the very moment of that agreement, now the agreement itself allowed for one bishop to be consecrated for the society, by the society, in the society. Although in the negotiations, Rome had always said, look, you don't need a bishop. If you're going to be in the official church, then there are bishops, plenty of bishops all over, and you can turn to the local bishops and they will do what you want. But the society naturally insisted upon its own bishop because we know how little reliance we can place upon the diocesan bishops.
Well, let's say the experience that traditional Catholics have had with the indult is proof of enough of that. Basically, almost none of the bishops have allowed the indult under the 1984 agreement.
That's right. And so, this being so, the society didn't want to accept Rome's idea that it could rely upon the normal bishops, So Rome, in the protocol, allowed for the principle of one bishop for the society. But immediately the question came by oral discussion, the same time that the protocol was being signed, there was oral discussion. Well, then when may we have this bishop? When can we consecrate this bishop? Can we consecrate him for the 30th of June? Ah, no, that's much too soon. Ah, well, then maybe August the 15th for the end of the Marian year. Oh, you see, the Roman holidays, there'll be nobody in Rome. That's impossible time of year. Well, then maybe the autumn. Yes, that's if there's time enough to study the dossiers. Well, at Christmas at any rate. Well, we'll see, we'll see, we'll see. In other words, in the talks surrounding the right, even the moment, at the very moment that that agreement was signed, in the words and conversations around the agreement, it was apparent to the Archbishop and to those with him that Rome, when it came to spelling out the nuts and bolts of the consecration of this bishop who had been allowed by Rome, it's clear that Rome didn't really mean to let it happen, that Rome was going to prevaricate. In other words, Rome writes into the agreement, a bishop will be allowed, but it doesn't put a date on it, and not putting a date on it, when it comes to a question of the date, Rome is going to prevaricate. In other words, it's just one means after another to put off the archbishop, to put him off, to slow him down, to give him promises, just enough promises to keep him going. But then whenever you're about to do something on those promises, you slow it down and put it off again. The archbishop had already put off the consecration, I think, at least three times. His original date was in September, then he put it back to December, then he put it to April, and finally he put it to June. There was no possibility of prevaricating any further. And so when the Archbishop understood that was Rome's mentality, he wrote a letter on the 2nd of June to the Pope saying that we're going to go ahead in any case, and the time has just not yet come for an agreement between us, and there's no real meeting of minds, and so we're going to have to take our own measures to guarantee the survival of tradition.
So the May 5th agreement was not really a final agreement, it was simply the draft for a future agreement.
It was a written basis of an agreement, yes, but the details, the practical details, the vital practical details from the society's point of view were not spelled out. I mean, the agreement did not say that Rome would refuse a bishop on such and such a date. It didn't say that Rome would grant a bishop on such and such a date. It just gave the agreement in principle for a bishop. But for the archbishop, the practical necessity was there. And so he immediately began discussing the date Rome began prevaricating. Another point at that same time is that at the time that the agreement was signed, the archbishop was handed a letter, I think by Cardinal Ratzinger, a draft letter which he, the archbishop, would address to the Pope. And in this letter, the archbishop would ask forgiveness for all his errors. In other words, Rome is absolutely not making a place for something which is in itself good and which should last inside the church. What Rome was doing is patching up a kind of agreement which would enable the traditionalists to be held inside the conciliar church while their resistance would be broken down.
Do you have concrete evidence that this was actually Rome's intention?
There's a very interesting conversation was reported to the Archbishop, which took place in Rome at that time. And in this conversation, Cardinal Ratzinger was telling somebody that somebody who might have reason to be concerned about an agreement. For instance, there are a lot of French politicians who at the time of the election of Le Pen and so on, the French politicians were very worried about the right-wing movement being led by Le Pen. And if the Vatican had come to an agreement with Archbishop Lefebvre and had approved, if the official church had approved of Archbishop Lefebvre, this would have given a great deal more credit, so to speak, through the right-wing religion to the right-wing politics. Not that Archbishop Lefebvre is connected with right-wing politics in any way, shape, size, or form, but that to approve the Archbishop would have been to approve the right-wing politics. Now, the establishment, the left-wing establishment in France, was dead scared of the right-wing politics of Le Pen. And so they must have gone to Rome to find out just what was going on, or to ask the Romans not to give any approval to Lefebvre before the elections. In any case, there it is. There's the remark of Cardinal Ratzinger to one of these politicians, which is reliably reported back to the Archbishop. And this remark was to the effect, don't worry about any agreement between Rome and Archbishop Lefebvre. Any such agreement is simply a provisional arrangement to enable us to synchronize the Akon priest back into the conciliar church.
So they were telling the Archbishop one thing and the French bishops another thing?
The French politicians, yes, that's exactly it, yes. The normal word for that kind of behavior is quite simply dishonest. If you want to be charitable, you'd have to say that the Roman authority, you'd have to suppose that the Roman authorities are sincerely convinced that the conciliar church is the true church, and they're sincerely convinced that the traditionalists are stray sheep, and they're sincerely convinced that a few fibs are all right in order to persuade all these stray sheep to get back into the true fold.
Was there also any evidence that the Archbishop was being pressured into accepting liberal principles?
The Cardinal also, at that time, in the negotiations, around the negotiations, immediately after the negotiations, he was all the time saying to the Archbishop, tradition is the church is the Second Vatican Council, and therefore we, who are of the conciliar church, we are the true tradition. And you, traditionalists, can have nothing to object to or to find wrong with the conciliar church. In fact, we are the living tradition. We in the conciliar church are living tradition. And therefore, whether you realize it or not, you must come back into the conciliar church. In other words, Cardinal Ratzinger is absolutely incapable of understanding the difference between the conciliar church and the traditional church. He has no grasp of what tradition really is or what tradition is about. And yes, he was all the time exercising a kind of suction upon the traditionalists to draw them into the ambit of these liberal principles.
Okay, so getting back to the May 5th agreement, it wasn't a final agreement. The details still had to be worked out, and then agreement could simply not be reached on these details.
The concrete application of the general principles, the agreement was general principles, which had to be put into concrete application. The urgent application for the Archbishop was the date of the consecration of a bishop. The moment he raised the question by word of mouth, immediately Rome began to prevaricate. And that's where the Archbishop saw that no agreement was possible. Rome made a slight concession on this question of the date of an archbishop. Through the month of May, as the negotiations continued, the archbishop was down in May again on May the 24th to see Cardinal Ratzinger. And Cardinal Ratzinger did allow for the bishop to be consecrated on April the 15th. So a date, one bishop was granted, the principle of one bishop was granted, and later in May, Cardinal Ratzinger did allow a date of August the 15th. But, when the Archbishop put forward three names for that August the 15th date, Rome rejected all three names. And so, it's not really I forget the exact text of the agreement, but it was something like, a candidate of the society presented by Archbishop Lefebvre and approved by the Pope. The Pope did not approve the Archbishop's candidates. Now, the Archbishop would obviously choose those who would really defend tradition. But it was apparent, absolutely apparent to the Archbishop, that Rome would choose only candidates that would help to ease traditionalists back into the conciliar church. And that's Rome's intention all along. And that's another point on which this refusal by Rome of all three candidates of the Archbishop, please send us another list of candidates, please send us another so that we can choose from those, this was another indication, a clear indication to the Archbishop that Rome's intention was never to protect tradition.
And also this commission that was supposed to regulate the state of affairs between the society and the church. Didn't they want a majority of members on that commission?
That is a crucial point, because on the basis of the agreement, the Archbishop said, when he was speaking to the seminarians on about, I think it was the 8th or 9th of June, he said that he signed the agreement of May the 5th somewhat with his fingertips, let's say somewhat reluctantly, because the Archbishop went to the absolute limits, because, for instance, the ongoing mechanism of this reattachment of the society and the church, the ongoing mechanism of the attachment was to be this Roman commission, which would have seven members, as you say, and of those seven, five would be Romans and only two would be members of the society. Now, how can two priests, youngish priests of the society, completely inexperienced in Roman ways, stand up to the pressure and the skills of five Romans used to negotiating and used to all the means that Rome has to exercise pressure? How could two stand up against five for the ongoing defense of the interests of traditionalists and tradition? It's just not a practical proposition. It's unpractical. It's unlikely and unpractical to the point where one can ask how the Archbishop even signed it in the first place. He must have hoped that the structure of the commission could be changed at some point, or that if Rome was of goodwill, then of course the five would help the two inside the commission to protect tradition. But it became apparent that this just wasn't the case.
So really what the society needed was really a state of independence from the conciliar bishops and from the modernist bureaucracy in Rome, if it were to be able to continue its work, and Rome would not offer that.
That is what the Archbishop asked for all along. He asked for independence from the diocesan bishops throughout the world, and he asked for a commission which would come directly under the Holy Father, which would not be interfered with by the other commissions in Rome or the other congregations in Rome or whatever. And neither of these he really got.
Could that be compared then to putting a fox in charge of the hen house?
That's exactly what it could be compared to. And there's a very interesting comparison. Or a very interesting case. Providentially, on the 2nd of June, the rector of the seminary in Econe received a letter from a former Econe seminarian who had headed up, 2 years previously, a group of seminarians that quit Econe and went down to Rome to start a traditional seminary in Rome under the approval and control and guidance of the Roman cardinals. And this little Roman traditional seminary was to be called Mater Ecclesiae, Mother of the Church. And it began in, I think, October of 1986. It was opened with the approval and blessing of Cardinal Ratzinger, Cardinal Innocenti, and others. And these seminarians, there was a group of about eight or nine of them that broke away from Econe, or that were thrown out of Econe because they meant to lead a lot of other... They wanted to really to break up Econe in a way, and take a lot of other seminaries with them. So they were finally thrown out of Econe. They went down to Rome. They started with the Tridentine Mass and with the cassock and with all kinds of promises that this little seminary would stay traditional and would help them and look after them. But over the next 2 years, as this seminarian wrote, bitterly disappointed, he wrote to the rector and said, "You were right and I was wrong. And Archbishop Lefebvre was right and I was wrong. And I hate to have to recognize it, but he was right all along the line." The story of the last 2 years, said the seminarian, is a story of our being continually bullied and betrayed. And we have been, the cassock has been taken away from us. We get the Tridentine Mass only once a week, or more and more rarely. We go to the Angelicum, which is used to be a very famous Dominican university in Rome. And we find errors, and we wanted, when we came back to the seminary in the evening, so to speak, we wanted the opportunity to straighten out these errors. That opportunity was taken away. In other words, of all the promises that were made to us to entice us away from Econe, none of the promises were kept. And now, says the seminarian, writing to the rector at the beginning of June last month, "Now," says the seminarian, "all of my comrades and colleagues, we all of us promised that we would hold fast, that we wouldn't let go, that we would remain firm." And he says, "The whole thing's gone. And all of those that swore they would never give up, they've all given up, and Mater Ecclesia is disintegrating. And I wrote the seminary in June. I fully expect Mater Ecclesia to close down. And actually, in the latter part of June, the early part of July, I forget exactly when, the news has come from Rome that Mater Ecclesia is closing down. And so that's a perfect example of the fox looking after the hen coop, as you say. Traditional enterprises, traditional houses, traditional seminarians cannot be entrusted to the care of these Roman cardinals, because these Roman cardinals do not understand tradition. And it has to be said, it's a terrible thing to say, but either they do not have the Catholic faith, and that's certainly true of some of them, they simply do not believe what the Catholic Church believes, or they at least do not have the spirit of the faith. I think, for instance, you couldn't say of a Cardinal Gagnon that he doesn't have the faith. I think he does have the faith, but he does not have the spirit of the faith. He hasn't got that spirit of combat, which is part of a real Catholic. A Catholic knows that the faith is something which finds itself in a hostile world, and it has to be fought for. It's going to mean a combat. It's going to mean a fight. But when Cardinal Gagnon gets back to Rome and in his Roman environment, he stops saying nice things about the society. He even starts suggesting slightly nasty things about the society, like he may have been deceived during his visit. The man is weak. The poor Cardinal Gagnon is weak, and he's the very best of them. He's weak. If he has the Catholic faith, which is very probable, he has not got the spirit of the faith. And so, at best, these Roman authorities are not going to have the courage to defend what's right. At worst, they are totally confused and wrong-headed about what is right. And to these people, either weak or hopelessly confused, or wicked even, some of them are wicked, the Freemasons in amongst them, tradition cannot be entrusted. There is no way in which our Lord's Church and the interests of our Lord's true Church can be put in their care.
Well, don't you think it's possible that without traditional enterprise being independent of these modernists, even if these modernists mean well, they'll still end up strangling the traditional movement?
Yes.
Simply because their thinking is not in line with that of tradition?
What their intentions are, God knows. How many of them are deep down and wicked villains because they're Freemasons who know exactly that they're destroying the Church? God knows. We don't know. We don't need to know. I know that the Society Superior General says that Cardinal Ratzinger is a sincere and an honest man. That's the impression he's had, or the impression he gives. The problem is that the corruption goes so deep in our world that, as you say, the mental confusion runs so deep that people can do very wicked things still being convinced that they're doing good things. And that, I think, is the case of a Cardinal Ratzinger. Assuming that his intentions are good, assuming, then the least that can be said is that his mind is so confused that with the best of intentions, he carries out with skill and perseverance a policy perfectly designed to destroy Catholic tradition. So whatever his intentions be, he's still a fox when it comes to chickens, because the chickens are still going to get eaten. That's for sure. I mean, the fox may have charming teeth and a sweet smile and nice pointed ears and a lovely red coat, but he's still going to eat the chickens. That's for sure and certain.
And yet Archbishop Lefebvre has been accused of being intransigent in these negotiations.
The Archbishop has said that he didn't really believe in entering into these negotiations in the first place, but he was persuaded to. And that's not to excuse the Archbishop if the Archbishop made a mistake, but I think that would have been his mentality, that would have been his mind. Namely, he was never really convinced in his mind that Rome meant business and that there was a hope for tradition and that Rome would make place for tradition. His mind just sees their unconvertible distaste for tradition. But I think his heart always longed for, and still longs for, you know, there to be no break, even apparent, between himself and the official structure of the Church. I mean, he's a devout Catholic and loves the Church and doesn't want to break with the Church and doesn't want even to seem to break with the Church. And so I think maybe his heart, prevailed over his head, especially when he was advised and urged by a number of people possibly to reopen negotiations and start negotiations. Because there were a lot of conservative Catholics. There are a lot of Catholics who admire what the Archbishop does and who absolutely want to stay in with the Roman authorities. And it's these people who are all urging the Archbishop, like Dr. De Saventem of Una Voce, for instance. They urged and urged and urged the Archbishop to negotiate, to come to an agreement, so that these people would not be forced to get off the fence, so that these people could go on having their cake and eat it. They could go on having their obedience to modernist Rome and at the same time have their attachment to Catholic tradition. They wanted it both ways. And so partly to give way to their wishes, partly, I don't know, the Archbishop entered into these negotiations, but sure enough, they just shattered upon the rock of the total irreconcilability of tradition and the Second Vatican Council.
Well, I think the very fact that he delayed the consecration four times shows that he wasn't intransigent at all.
That's very true. He went the full 9 yards and 10 or 11 yards with Rome in order to try to find some agreement, but it couldn't be found. There's just no meeting of minds.
Now, okay, the negotiations broke off. Then what happened at the consecrations on June 30th?
It was a historic and a very moving occasion. There was a large crowd. I don't know, estimated maybe 10,000 people. Very devout, very attentive, and very supportive of what the Archbishop was doing. In the ceremony itself, there was present, what the media hardly mentioned, also Bishop de Castro Maia, the bishop from Campos in Brazil, quite independent of the society, but he's the one bishop in the whole world who has been publicly supporting and backing the Archbishop. And he was there. The ceremony began with a longish sermon of the Archbishop, justifying and explaining what he was doing. And the people in attendance fully supported what the Archbishop was saying. That was clear from their applause. And then after that, Bishop de Castro Maia gave a short little sermon, which was as packed with punch as it was short. And he said, I am here in order to profess my faith. He said, St. Thomas Aquinas says a Catholic doesn't always have to profess his faith, but when the faith is in danger, then he must do. And Bishop de Castro Maia said, the faith today is in terrible danger, and that's why I'm here, to demonstrate my complete public solidarity with Archbishop Lefebvre. And the Bishop de Castro Maia said, you know, that the Catholic people are being deceived by their bishops. Then the ceremony took place, which is a very majestic and beautiful ceremony, as the Church's great ceremonies always are. And again, after the ceremony, the people were tremendously joyful, enthusiastic and joyful. And they're obviously delighted to have four more bishops, in the line of the thinking of Archbishop Lefebvre and Bishop de Castro Maia.
And why did the Archbishop feel it necessary to conduct these consecrations, even though Rome told him not to?
Because the survival of Catholic tradition is at stake. He's 82, nearly 83 years old, coming up to 83 years old. He has to die soon. He can no longer undertake the long journeys, intercontinental journeys, that for many, many years through his 70s he heroically used to do, once a year. He would come to the United States and go all around the United States confirming. If he himself now is too old to do that, all of these children in the United States would not be confirmed. Or they would have to go to the diocesan bishops, with whom they absolutely can't be sure that the sacrament is valid. And so here are all of these parents, for instance, being deprived of a reliable sacrament of confirmation for their children. The people need a bishop. And then, not only in America, but also in France and in all the other countries of the world, where the Archbishop is going to be able to travel less and less. And then the other sacrament that a bishop gives is, of course, ordinations. There's a seminary now in the United States. It's absurd to have, for the seven orders, for the four minor orders and for three major orders, each of 40, 50, 60 seminarians going over to Europe once a year. It's an absolute intrinsic absurdity. What is absolutely needed is for a bishop to be here in the United States. Now, this is what the bishop himself did for many years, but he can't do it anymore. The American Catholics need these reliable priests, with the grace of God, reliable, these priests absolutely need a bishop to give them ordinations. The archbishop can't do it himself. In that case, the faith, the salvation of the people, their sacraments, need priests. Priests need a bishop. The archbishop has to hand down the grace of the bishopric, which he himself received from Cardinal Jenner.
Is the situation in the church that bad that the Novus Ordo bishops cannot be relied on at all?
Unfortunately, yes. It really is that bad. Just take a look at the state of the modern seminaries. The seminaries are either empty, and the seminaries that are in the official seminaries are either empty, or the seminaries that are still in these official seminaries are vigorously taught heresy. They're encouraged to go out on the town at night. They're encouraged to have girlfriends. All kinds of extraordinary things which just absolutely cannot make a proper Catholic priest. There are good seminarians who tell of the heroic lengths that they have to go to try and stay in the seminary and get themselves ordained. But even if they get ordained, they then go out into a diocese where they're bullied by the bishop if they show half an inclination to practice or promote traditional Catholicism. The crisis is desperate, absolutely desperate.
I would agree with you, because I have in front of me here a little booklet that we published, and it's by a former seminarian at Canada's most conservative seminary. At this seminary, they're taught all kinds of heresies, such as that the resurrection never really happened as a historical event, it was just symbolic. They are taught that homosexuality has merit at Canada's most conservative seminary. Yeah. So with this situation, if it weren't for the seminaries of the Society of St. Pius X, you might be in a situation in a few years where there simply aren't any Orthodox priests.
When a Catholic, there's a Latin saying which says the corruption of the best is the worst. And when a Catholic school goes corrupt, it's going to be much worse than a public school. When a Catholic seminary goes corrupt, it's going to be an absolute den of iniquity. And that, just in point of fact, judged by Catholic faith and Catholic morals, dens of iniquity is what one has to say most Catholic seminaries today have become. It's desperate. There are going to be no proper priests, no proper bishops, no sacrifice of the Mass. The Catholic Church is being destroyed. So the crisis is desperate.
Do you think that the crisis has reached the point where the very survival of the faith is at stake now?
Bishop de Castromaya thinks so, yes. And the Archbishop certainly thinks so. And anyone who properly understands his Catholic faith realizes that it isn't just a question of language, it isn't just a question of vestments, it isn't just a question of church buildings, it's the very faith which is at stake. And the behavior of Cardinal Ratzinger shows that the man just does not understand Catholic tradition. He does not understand the faith. It's very questionable whether Cardinal Ratzinger still has the Catholic faith.
But as a result of these consecrations, is not Archbishop Lefebvre excommunicated?
According to the Roman Congregation for Bishops, yes, because, of course, even before the end of the ceremony, that's the speed with which Rome smashed the Archbishop, contrasted with the slowness with which it smashes all the liberals and with which it slaps the liberals on the wrist who are running riot through the church. According to the Roman Congregation for Bishops, yes, the Archbishop has automatically excommunicated himself and the bishops that were consecrated as well. But according to any right understanding of canon law, not at all.
Why is that?
Because canon law is full of common sense. The Church's law is full of common sense. And what it says is, canons 1323 and 1324, it says that if a man is acting in an emergency, then and he does something in an emergency which would normally incur an automatic sanction, if he does it in an emergency, it doesn't incur the sanction it would normally incur. Take the comparison of, if your neighbor's house is burning down, you don't have to ask his permission to run across the lawn with a fire hose. If you're in an emergency, you don't have to, the penalties foreseen by the law don't apply because you're acting in an emergency. The law is not, the law that you don't walk across your neighbor's lawn is not meant to, is not designed to allow your neighbor's house to burn down. It's common sense. And so the same here. The law forbidding a bishop to consecrate another bishop without the Pope's permission is a normal law and it's an absolutely right and wise law. But in an emergency, when the church is burning down, when the bishops are deceiving the people, as Bishop de Castromaia says, when the people are being deceived and tricked out of their Catholic faith and their eternal salvation is being gravely endangered, you will not get punished. If that's the reason why you act, the punishment normally foreseen by the law just doesn't apply. And of course the Archbishop is acting in an emergency. You have to deny the emergency in order to deny the whole crisis in the church, to deny the...
Which is what the modernists do. They say we're in the midst of a big renewal.
Well, that's it, you see. I mean, when your mind is turned upside down and inside out like that, I mean, 2 and 2 is 5, the sun... is dark and water is dry and fire is cold. When people lose their grip on facts to that point, what can you do? You don't have to take them seriously, that's for sure. Then canon law goes on. Firstly, if you act in an emergency, the sanction, the normally automatic sanction will not be automatic, and that's the case here. Secondly, even if you are mistaken in thinking that there's an emergency, still the sanction doesn't apply according to church law. So that even if Archbishop Bebe was mistaken in thinking there's a crisis, since he acts thinking that there is, the sanction doesn't apply. And thirdly, even if a man is guiltily mistaken, that's say he is at fault for thinking that there is an emergency when there isn't, still the sanction will not apply, and the judge must moderate the penalty. If a judge is going to punish him for it, the penalty must be less than what is foreseen in canon law. And so, according to canon law, there is no way in which the archbishop could be automatically excommunicated for what he's just done.
Is this excommunication valid?
No. The excommunication is intrinsically invalid, and therefore there applies what the great St. Robert Bellarmine said at the time of the Counter-Reformation: when the Supreme Pontiff pronounces a sentence of excommunication which is unjust or null, it must not be accepted without, however, straying from the respect due to the Holy See. The Archbishop Lefebvre has never lacked the due respect for the Holy See, but he's not going to pay any attention to this excommunication any more than he paid to his suspension back in 1976.
And what should the reaction of the laity be to this excommunication?
Exactly the same. These sanctions are intrinsically null and void. They shouldn't pay any attention at all. I can tell you how the Society Superiors reacted. Meetings were of the Society Superiors from all over the world, District Superiors, Seminary Superiors, Autonomous House Superiors, were held the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday after the consecrations on the 30th of June. And the superiors, led by their superior general, Father Schmidberger, the superiors wrote a letter to Cardinal Gantin, who had notified us of our excommunication, and they wrote to him saying, more or less, it was very elegantly said, of course, but this is what was said: "Dear Cardinal, you have seen fit to excommunicate these 6 bishops. Would you please also excommunicate us? Because we would consider that an excommunication to be a badge of honor and a badge of orthodoxy for the faithful who need to know that they're following Catholic priests and not anti-Catholic priests." It was said much more elegantly than that, but that was the gist of it. Please excommunicate us. And the laity in the canton of the valley, which is where Econe is situated, were also going to write a letter to exactly the same effect.
Now, I understand that there are some Roman officials are making threats to supporters of Archbishop Lefebvre that they want to excommunicate these people as well. What should be the response of the laity to all these threats?
Scorn. Scorn. Respect always. Just like our Lord nevertheless respected Annas, although Annas was on the point of crucifying him. And just like St. Paul also, in the Acts of the Apostles we read, respected the high priest, although the high priest was still misbehaving. Nevertheless, we must respect the authorities of the church simply because they are the authorities of our Lord's church. But for these contemptible measures, intrinsically null and void, proceeding either from cowardice or from total confusion or from wickedness, for such null measures, such meaningless measures before God, Catholics should need have little but scorn. They should remember, of course, always that Saint Athanasius, the great champion of the faith, Saint Athanasius, was excommunicated by the Pope Liberius in the year 359, I think it was, at the time of the Arian crisis. Pope Liberius was wrong, Saint Athanasius was right. Saint Athanasius is being canonized, and undoubtedly before God, Pope Liberius' excommunication, declaring that Athanasius was outside of the church, was absolute nonsense. Nobody was more inside the church, nobody stayed more faithfully within the church than St. Athanasius at the time of the Arian crisis. Practically all the other bishops were out of the church by their cowardice or complicity with the Arian heresy. Athanasius stood foursquare within. He was absolutely persecuted. He was declared excommunicated, but the measure was undoubtedly before God simply null and void, nothing.
Well, I have to ask the question, who should be excommunicating whom? Because it seems like, to me, it's an upside-down situation. On one hand, you have bishops, like in front of me here, I have an article about Bishop Daru. He's celebrating a clown mass. By the way, he rejects most of the doctrines of the Catholic faith. He also rejects its social teaching because he's a supporter of communism, and yet he is a bishop in good standing, and it's Archbishop Lefebvre, who has done the best he can to build up the faith, who is excommunicated.
The situation is upside down in all kinds of ways today. When Archbishop Lefebvre has visited the Holy Office to be interrogated or interviewed by the authorities, these authorities, today's authorities of the Church, the Archbishop has once or twice said to them, I should be in your chair and you should be in my chair. You should be the ones being questioned and I should be doing the questioning. And the Archbishop has also said when he's appeared in the Holy Office or the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, he says, I am at home here. This is my home, so to speak, because I am the defender of the faith and this office is meant for the defense of the faith. But the Roman authorities presently in those offices are exactly like cuckoos in the nest. They've pushed out the little birds that should be there, and they're going cuckoo, 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 and they expect Catholics to take them seriously. When they go cuckoo, 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 no way, no way.
Well, I think the answer to why this upside-down situation has occurred is that, really, to a large extent, we're living in a post-Christian era, even to the point where the churches have been de-Christianized to a large extent. So it's logical that they would have to get rid of the true Catholics, because these people are an embarrassment to them.
The Archbishop has said that there is nobody so sectarian as a liberal. The liberals are people who have compromised and betrayed the truth, and they correspondingly persecute those that stay faithful to the truth. And so the liberals pretend to be all sweet and nice and tolerant and cozy and friendly with everybody, but they're not friendly with those that stay faithful to the truth, because whoever stays faithful to the truth attacks their liberalism. I always think it's like if you wanted to set up a mathematics business in which you would teach that 2 and 2 is 5, you might tolerate somebody 2 and 2 is 7. You could stay in business alongside somebody who said 2 and 2 is 1,000,000. But the competitor that you can't stand is the one who says that 2 and 2 is 4, because he's finally going to put you out of business. The liberals cannot stand Archbishop Lefebvre, because they know that at the end of the line he's going to put them out of business, because he's telling the truth and they've abandoned the truth. And that's why where this savage persecution comes from. They will allow somebody like Father Charles Curran and Archbishop Hunthausen to run around the vineyard of the Lord like a wild boar and to ravage the vines. But an Archbishop Lefebvre, they stamp on him even before the ceremony is over. Their press spokesman is making declarations nonsense declarations that the Archbishop has excommunicated himself.
Well, it's almost as if the Church has a death wish, because any organization which tolerates bad behavior, which tears the Church down, and excommunicates supposedly those that are building up new convents and churches, is going to end up with an organization that's going to be in a very rundown state.
Malcolm Muggeridge is very interesting. He, on this question of the death wish of liberalism, liberals have a death wish. And our whole society and civilization, if you can call it that today, is liberal through and through, and it's got the death wish through and through. And AIDS is simply a symptom, and abortion, this terrible abortion, is that's a symptom of this death wish, and AIDS is simply another symptom. Our whole civilization is heading for death. And people want death because their lives and their minds and their souls are so fouled up that they want death. Those in our rotten civilization who still want the truth, who don't want death, who want life and who want the truth, they can find their way. God has not abandoned his church. Archbishop Lefebvre is still there. Bishop de Castromaire is still there. The truth is still there to be seen. It is to be defended. But most people don't want the truth. And that's why there's this massive death wish. And as you say, these officials in the church want to destroy the church.
Wittingly or unwittingly.
Yes, wittingly or unwittingly. Only a few of them probably consciously know exactly what they're doing to destroy the church, the Freemasons or whoever, but it's an instinctive thing. These liberal ideas rot a man, and his instincts turn rotten, and his instincts turn for death. And you can see it through our newspapers, through our media, all the time. This constant building up of traitors, this protection of traitors, this protection of homosexuals, for instance, this protection of all those people that are going to destroy our society, and this destruction, on the other hand, of people like Archbishop Lefebvre, who would preserve the health of our society.
Now let's look at another argument. Has not Archbishop Lefebvre created a schism through his action of consecrating bishops?
No way. No way. A schism means cutting off or breaking off from the church. But the church, the Catholic Church, is the faith. The faith is where the church is. And it's these Roman officials who are abandoning the faith because they don't believe what Catholics always used to believe. They just don't believe it, as you say, with the heresies in the Angelicum and so on. And on the other hand, the Archbishop, Archbishop Lefebvre, and those who keep the tradition absolutely hold the Catholic faith, and they drop not one iota or tittle of the Catholic faith. That's on the one side. And on the other side, the Romans are abandoning the faith, the Archbishop is keeping the faith. And so, on the one side, the Romans are cutting with the church, the Catholic Church, the Church of the Catholic faith, whereas the Archbishop is preserving and building and tightly united to the Church of the Catholic faith. Who's doing the breaking? Who's doing the cutting? It's the Romans that have done it, starting with Vatican II. That was the great point of rupture.
So you're just asking the question then, who are the real schismatics? Is it these heretical bishops and theologians, or is it Archbishop Lefebvre? The question is thrown right back at them.
Absolutely, the question rebounds in their face. Because you've got to stop talking about what looks like the Catholic Church, the appearance of the Catholic Church. You've got to talk about the reality, which is the Church of the Catholic faith. And the Church of the it's clear that the Romans have broken with the Church of the Catholic faith, which is the true church. And that Archbishop Lefebvre is the greatest champion of the Church of the Catholic faith. So the schismatics are these Roman authorities. They're the ones that are really schismatic.
But in one sense, couldn't one say that Archbishop Lefebvre is schismatic because he defied an actual order from the Pope himself?
If that order had been the Catholic order of a Catholic Pope, yes, then Archbishop Lefebvre, in an important matter, then Archbishop Lefebvre would have been schismatic if he had broken off, refused the authority of the Pope, or refused communion with the Pope. That would be schismatic. But when it's an un-Catholic order, proceeding for un-Catholic reasons from a half-Catholic, half-un-Catholic Pope, certainly not Catholic in everything that he does and says, or thinks, or believes. When it's that kind of an order, to refuse that order is neither disobedience, nor disunity, nor schism, nor anything else you care to call it. It's to refuse that kind of an order is sanity itself, is common sense and sanity, and the defense of the faith.
It's like Saint Athanasius then disobeying Pope Liberius.
That's right. I mean, the people have got, Catholics and Protestants have got the wrong idea of infallibility. They think that the Church's doctrine of infallibility means that the Pope is going to be infallible in everything he does and says. The Catholic Church has never taught that. whatever Protestants have thought the Catholic Church has taught, or whatever Catholics have thought that the Catholic Church taught. That's not what the Catholic Church taught. The Catholic Church teaches that the Pope is only infallible when there are certain strict conditions. He's got to be he's got to be defining a point of faith and morals as Pope, and with the intention to bind the whole church. And when he's not doing that, he's not infallible. And these recent liberal popes, they refuse to engage their infallible authority, and therefore there's nothing they say that need be right.
But isn't Archbishop Lefebvre undermining the papacy in what he's doing?
He's doing the exact opposite. He's building the papacy. Imagine an ice salesman insisting on selling his wares in the open sunshine, right? Mm-hmm. He's going to destroy his own business. Imagine then a friend coming up to him and saying, hey, look, get back into the shade. For goodness sake, get back into the shade. And the ice salesman doesn't like being told that. But it's true friendship to tell him to get back into the shade, because it's in the nature of his business that it should be in the shade. The popes, the orders that these recent popes are giving against Archbishop Lefebvre are absolutely anti-Catholic. Of a nature designed to destroy the Catholic Church and to destroy the papacy. The Archbishop's ideas are such as to protect and to defend the papacy. If only the Pope would do what the Archbishop says, the papacy would be saved. If this Pope insists on continuing on doing what he thinks, he's going to destroy the papacy. The Pope is his own worst enemy at the moment, and Archbishop Lefebvre is his best friend.
Like with the CC meeting or events like that, you mean?
They're crazy. From the Catholic point of view, they're absolutely crazy. The Catholic religion is exclusive. There is no other religion which is true. The Catholic religion is the one and only true religion, founded by God, and the only religion by which we can go to heaven and save our souls. And all other religions are more or less false. That's what the Catholic Church always taught. To teach now that all religions are perfectly all right is to destroy the very heart of Catholicism. You destroy the Church because you are undoing an essential claim of the Church. If the Catholic Church is not the only true religion, it's nothing. Our Lord says it's fit to be thrown out and trampled upon. The moment it stops claiming to be the one and only true religion, all you can do with it is throw it out and trample on it. And that's what's happening.
Now let's look at another issue along the same lines as the papacy. Is the Archbishop now taking instead of a contest position as a result of these consecrations?
No, I know of nothing that the Archbishop has said or that indicates that he believes that the see of Peter is vacant. In other words, there isn't a pope. There's no one on the chair of Peter. The Archbishop's attitude down all of these years has been, maybe one day evidence will come out to prove that these popes weren't really popes. But until that evidence comes out, we've got the great weight of supposition is in favor of their being popes. And so we have to behave. We must behave as though they are popes. I don't think the Archbishop would have behaved with such respect towards Pope John Paul II if he didn't think that he really was the Pope.
Now, we should clarify a statement that was made regarding Roman positions being held by antichrists, because that has caused concern among a number of traditional Catholics.
It's true that at the beginning of a letter written, I think, in August of last year, the Archbishop wrote that about all the positions of authority in Rome being occupied by antichrists, in the plural, with a small a. What does he mean by that? The Church teaches that the Antichrist, with a capital A, is going to be one man at the end of time, and he's going to be a very, very wicked man, rising up against God and setting the whole world in revolt against God, and the most terrible persecution of the Catholic Church ever in all history. That's the Antichrist. But now, before the Antichrist comes, there are going to be several agents of his who are working, beavering away, and preparing for him to come, all doing the work of Satan, all doing evil work, but none of them have anything like the stature of the Antichrist. All of them, more or less, serving Satan. Serving him wittingly, willingly, unwittingly, unwillingly, God knows. But in any case, they're doing the work of evil. What the Archbishop is simply saying is that your Cardinal Ratzinger's, your Cardinal Gagnon's, your your Cardinal Oddi, even the best of them, and your Pope John Paul II, these people holding positions of authority in Rome are, wittingly or unwittingly, willingly or unwillingly, doing the work of preparing for the coming of the Antichrist. And they're doing that work of preparing for the coming of the Antichrist by helping to destroy and undermine and dissolve Catholic tradition, by helping to destroy the Church and dissolve tradition.
So the Arch didn't mean it in the sense that John Paul II is the person of the Antichrist.
Of course not, because that is evident from the text of his letter, which says the position, it's all in the plural, the positions of authority in Rome today being occupied by Antichrists, with a small a. It's very clear that what he's meaning is that these cardinals are doing the work of preparing for the Antichrist.
Yes, in fact, I think in that very same letter, he says, I beseech you to remain attached to the See of Peter.
Well, that's right. The attachment to the papacy is a deep, deep Catholic principle, and is a deep principle of Archbishop Lefebvre. I mean, he would be horrified if he felt that in the work that he began, the work that he founded of the Society of St. Pius X, he would be horrified if he knew that large numbers of the society were beginning to hate the Pope, or beginning to hate the papacy, or beginning to reject altogether the very principle of authority in Rome. The Archbishop Lefebvre himself is deeply Roman. He loves Rome. He loves Catholic Rome. He hates this modernist Rome, but he loves Catholic Rome.
Well, in a sense, hasn't this confusion about Archbishop Lefebvre's attitude towards the Pope resulted to a certain extent because of a modern era of a misunderstanding of the virtue of charity? In that by the virtue of charity, sometimes you have to exercise fraternal correction.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to criticize really in order to help these people.
It's known as being cruel in order to be kind. I mean, our Lord himself in the Gospels every now and again or occasionally gives a most terrible tongue lashing to the Pharisees. But that's after he's tried everything else. It's an act of charity. I mean, everything our Lord did was a sublime act of charity. And even this tongue lashing to the Pharisees is an act of charity. It's the kindest thing he could do for the Pharisees because, you know, milk and honey have failed, so he's going to have to use gall and vinegar. Yes, I mean, the Archbishop has tried kindness and respect and deference to these Roman authorities, but on the bottom line, he can't abandon the truth, and the greatest kindness he can do for these authorities is to defend the truth and hold it up in front of them.
In a sense, then, the situation that we're really in, it's not so much that traditional Catholics are against the person of these Roman authorities. What we really have is a clash of two different religions, of two different ideologies. That's the way I would see it.
That's very much the case. I mean, you've got the traditional Catholic religion, which is the true Catholic religion of 2,000 years, and then you've got this secular humanist Catholicism of the Second Vatican Council, which is a dummy substitute. And there is a war to the death. It's an absolute state of war between these two religions. And the Catholics are being persecuted by the secular humanists. And if the Catholics regained control or regained power, they would persecute the secular humanists. That's it. They would persecute the heretics. We would persecute the heretics. Don't let's be under any soft illusion about when the Catholics get back, they're going to allow a liberal society. No, if the Catholics regain control, they will excommunicate the heretics from the Church. And the moment excommunications start being again true excommunications, the Church will immediately start rising out of the ashes. Because excommunication is an instrument of God. It's a terrifying instrument if it's properly used and wisely used. It's a gift of God to His Church. Our Lord says, if he refuses to hear you, raise it in front of a few people. If he still refuses to hear you, let him be a publican, let him be outside the church. I mean, excommunication is the will of God for those who offend gravely against the Catholic faith, which is the very heart of the Catholic Church. But this Pope is using excommunication in order to punish those who defend the faith. It's an absolute absurdity.
There's also, it's another way it's been used. It was sort of a tactical maneuver against the Archbishop in that they backed him into a corner, in that he had to do it in order for tradition to continue, for the society to continue. And then having backed him in that corner, when the Archbishop steps out of it, they immediately excommunicate him.
Yes.
It's being used as a political weapon.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it's politics. It's maneuvering and politics. It's absolutely not the will of God. In the Epistle to the Philippians, St. Paul says, how many there are that seek their own interests and not the interests of Christ. And that's what we've got here. These officials of the church are using the instruments of God, the weapons of God, not to do the work of our Lord Jesus Christ, but to do the work of the Antichrist. It's terrible to have to say so, but that's just the way it is.
Could, in effect, we look at the situation of the church today as a revolution, that a revolution occurred in the church at and after Vatican II?
The interesting thing, as several people have pointed out, is that both the left wing, as if you like to use that language, and the right wing as agree that Vatican II was the French Revolution inside the church. It was 1789 inside the Catholic Church. Now, the left wing has said it, like Cardinal Sunens, and Archbishop Lefebvre says it. So if two people so completely opposed say it, you've got to assume that there could easily be some truth in it. Indeed, the ideas of Vatican II are the ideas of the French Revolution. And the Vatican II is intrinsically revolutionary, and this secular humanism presently being used to dummy for and to destroy Catholicism is intrinsically revolutionary. It's the revolution of Satan rising up and saying, I will not serve. I will not be told what to think or what to do by anybody else. I will do as I will think as I like, and I will do as I like. And that is religious liberty. I am not bound to be a Catholic. I can follow the religion of my conscience. Now, the Catholic Church never admitted that. Never, never, never admitted that man could follow any religion like. But with Vatican II, that's certainly the result of the Declaration on Religious Liberty, that everybody thinks that people can follow the religion of their conscience.
But the same charge is now being leveled against the Archbishop in that he's setting himself up as sort of the grand arbiter of what is the Catholic religion.
He's doing no such thing, is the easy answer. He's doing no such thing. His standard in yardstick is what the Church has done and said for 2,000 years. And to prove it, all you've got to do is open up the textbooks and open up the manuals and see what the councils define, what the councils said, especially what the popes of the last century and a half have said against this liberal modern world and its poisonous liberal ideas. And that is the consistent and steady voice of the Church. That's the wisdom of the Church. That's what the Church is. The Archbishop is inventing nothing. There are no novelties in what he says. There's nothing original in what he says. There's nothing personal in what he says. It's all simply exactly what the Church always said. So there's no way in which he can be accused of arbitrarily setting up his own opinions or his own ideas or his own church. He's simply defending what's always been.
He's Catholic. Simply following tradition, in other words.
Well, yes, he's following tradition. He's maintaining what, into the 20th century, into this latter dark part of the 20th century, he's maintaining what the Catholic Church has always maintained, like the great popes did. Pope Pius X with his encyclical against modernism. Pope Pius IX with his Syllabus of Errors. I mean, a lot of people today think that the Syllabus of Errors was more or less misguided, but it's not true at all. The Syllabus was a great document, and that is Catholicism standing square and tall against the rottenness of the modern world, already mostly there in the middle of the 19th century.
So then it sort of coincides then with what Bishop Castro Meyer said in his theological statement about the consecrations, that it's really the good of the faith and the salvation of souls are the ultimate test of what is true obedience and what is not true obedience.
That's right. And by that test, Archbishop Lefebvre and Bishop de Castromare are the most obedient of bishops. This will become apparent, just like St. Athanasius was finally vindicated, and everyone knew that Pope Liberius had made the mistake. It's going to be apparent. Before the Archbishop's death, after the Archbishop's death, I don't know. But it's certain that he will sooner or later be vindicated. Only it may take a Russian invasion to bring the Roman churchmen to their senses. Pope Pius X, in 1908-1909, had a vision of himself or his successor, he wasn't sure which, or one of his successors. He had a vision of him fleeing Rome over the bodies of his dead priests. The last time the Pope had to flee Rome was in 1848. That was Pope Pius IX, when there was a Freemasonic revolution in Italy. And the Pope had to flee for his life in disguise. And he was 18 months out of Rome, down in the south. it's very possible that the Russians are going to have to invade Europe for the churchmen to realize what the score really is. Because with these latest measures against the Archbishop, Rome is certainly persisting in its folly.
Now, most revolutions go through a moderate phase and a radical phase. Now, we could now be entering into the radical phase, because up till now, Rome has employed the Archbishop as a means of slowing down the revolution. Now, this move has actually emboldened these liberals. So I think one could easily find the situation in the church getting much worse.
That's interesting, and it's definitely a possibility. Since all your average priests and average bishops throughout the world have seen their head authority in Rome condemning Archbishop Lefebvre, they've got to do one of two things. They've either got to say the authorities are wrong and Archbishop Lefebvre is right, and I'm going to stand by Archbishop Lefebvre, whatever the consequences are, or they've got to say Rome is right, Rome is right, Rome is right, the Pope, the Pope, the Pope, in which case they've got to themselves also despise and scorn what Archbishop Lefebvre stands for, and that will mean a rapid, as you say, a rapid worsening of the situation of the church everywhere.
And another characteristic of revolutions is that there is generally a reign of terror. That's what happened in the French Revolution. They killed hundreds of thousands of people, including thousands of noblemen. Now, what seems to be happening is the same thing, and it's not just the fact that Archbishop Lefebvre was supposedly excommunicated. On the same day that that happened, a group of Oratorian fathers in the Archdiocese of Ottawa, who are conservative, who offer a Latin Novus Ordo Mass, were ordered to leave the diocese, even though they had no connection whatsoever to Archbishop Lefebvre.
Oh, that's it. I mean, these are your bishops and your archbishops throughout the world bending with the wind. Which way Rome blows, they incline and they lean. It's interesting what you say, because a reign of terror may be inside the church beginning. It's certain that in Cardinal Gantin's notification of excommunication, quote-unquote, one of the last sentences is a threat that priests and Catholics should not follow these schismatic bishops, otherwise they themselves will incur automatic excommunication.
So I think that's a good way to conclude this interview. Thank you, Bishop Williams.